Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you're a returning subscriber, welcome. I hope you're having an amazing day. So you see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So please hit that subscribe button. We are here with Leona Lewis in our Open to Work series. Leona is a thought leader in the ethics and compliance space that I've been excited to get on here and kind of pick her brain a little bit about how she got into the game, what she's looking for, things that she has done, accomplishments, and so forth. So, Leona, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here, Nick. I'm really happy to join you.
Oh, good. Yeah. How did we get linked up? Was it Lisa Beth who introduced us?
I think it was Lisa Beth. Yeah.
Yeah, she is like the compliance connector. She's like the queen.
She is.
In compliance. It was really great.
She is. We go way back. We used to work together at a big company years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the same legal department.
Oh, very cool. So maybe that's kind of a cool place to start. You know, this is part of our series Open to Work, where we want to shine the light on smart people who care within the compliance space. So, you know, how did you get into the compliance game? Mm-hmm. And what was it about it that has kept you in it this time?
Well, I got into the compliance game back in the day when I was working for a large company, and I was a traditional business lawyer. I had negotiating contracts, and then I started supporting a team that had very different regulatory obligations than your typical business case. Now, so this was a retailer. So the people who made up this business group were ex-merchants who were now trying to build their own products. And the ex-merchants had started in this area just looking at this business as the same transactional business they formerly had when they were buying other brands and putting them on shelves. But this one, it's your brand. And so the risk and regulatory positioning of that is very different. And I really wasn't satisfied with just telling the business group what the law was. I wanted to collaborate with them in order to implement solutions to reduce the risk. So that's really where it started. I mean, it started with that. I think that, I love contracts. Contracts are great, but having the same conversation with the same people a few hundred times can wear on a person. So I needed new things. I wanted to go into new areas. I liked being part of something that for the company was novel. And so they needed somebody who could actually navigate that ambiguity and help them, put them in the best position possible with actually these regulatory areas that have a lot of reputational impact, like product safety.
So tell me some more about that sort of that novelty of it and that ambiguity in the gray and what your kind of unique skill set and sort of mentality was able to, provide some clarity within.
I think that I don't look at things just reactively. I look at them proactively in the sense that everything will change. Everything you think that you're doing now has a risk that it's going to change, and everything that the law says also changes.
Right.
Issues with especially compliance aren't so much issues of the law usually, because most laws change relatively slowly, but businesses change extremely quickly. So the application of the law to them is what really changes. So my ability to deal with change and to set up a process and communication with the business to deal with the changes in risk in what's going on in a routine, rational way without, basically trying to avoid a situation where everything was an 11th hour emergency as much as possible.
Right.
Was very helpful.
Right. So what was the kind of ethos of that approach? I mean, because you're really pulling together a lot of different disparate skills in a way, right? It's the analytical ability. It's that sort of lawyer brain. It's the risk risk measuring or risk noticing or whatever you want to kind of call that. And then there's got to be some persuasion as well as you're cross-functional groups.
Definitely. Part of the persuasion was linking the issue to their business. In this case, you know, in the past, back in the day, it was, you know, selling goods. And it's not so much, you know, the business sometimes would think of it as, well, if I put something on the shelf, what's the chances something will go wrong? But I explained to them, if you are successful and you put enough products on the shelf, something actually will go wrong. It's a certainty. Like if you are successful and you do something an infinite number of times, something is going to go wrong.
Right.
And the business doesn't make money just putting one product on the shelf. They make money putting lots of products on the shelves, millions of products, sales to millions of people, millions of times. And it's not, you know, it's the matter of how scale and the business model actually means that this is a problem you're going to need to deal with. It's not hypothetical. Mm-hmm. And I think they understood at some point, oh no, this isn't just what if. This is going to happen. How do we make the possibility of it happen smaller? Yeah. And how do we make our reaction to this issue better? Not a discussion of this is the requirements of the rules. How do we be perfect? Because that's an important distinction. Yeah, because I had to get them off the idea of you're coming to me with these ideas about rules and I can't be perfect. So what the heck?
So it should be nothing.
It's like, right. That's not the discussion. The discussion is smaller and better. How do we make the risks smaller? How do we make our reaction better?
Right.
So basically, how do we lower the chances that something bad will happen? And if something bad happens, how do we make the damage smaller?
So I think a lot of people who come in to, especially from like the lawyer game, mm-hmm. who come into compliance, that's a light bulb moment that they have to arrive at, because mm-hmm. there's not this binary sort of risk elimination. It's not even possible. You know what I'm saying?
It's not possible. It's also, it sets you up with a conversation with the business that isn't helpful. Like discussing, like trying to debate with them their level of ability to be perfect is not a helpful conversation. The conversation is getting from here to something better. And then honestly, usually the business can get even better than that. They don't necessarily, sometimes until they start doing it, they don't understand that they can do it. But you kind of, if you're going to be arguing about perfection, you will never get started.
Right.
You know, so.
Why is that such a hard light bulb for some folks to get turned on who are maybe have been in the compliance game, you know, for a while? What do you think the mental block there is?
I think the mental block is people feel that they're not doing their jobs unless they're hammering on somebody to be perfect.
Oh, interesting.
I mean,
that's an interesting point, actually.
I think you feel a duty that somehow this is a choice between non-compliance and failure or total compliance and success instead of bring the business along on a journey to be more compliant or at least reduce the risks of non-compliance. This is a discussion about, it's not a discussion about a degree and sort of, well, we just got to be,
that's a good point.
Know, only somewhat compliant. It's more a discussion of likelihood of non-compliance, right? It's like, you need to find, there are definitely tactics that can be put into play when you have a discussion about, well, how do we make this non-compliant issue less likely?
Right.
And that is a conversation somehow. It's possible that there are compliance people, or at least the reputation of compliance is not that. People are concerned that you're going to come to them and beat them up over not being perfect.
Yeah, and that's not probably some baseless stereotype. It's probably from some
It's probably coming from
a bunch of interactions.
I think that's true. And also from a legal risk area, from lawyers' point of view, they're trained lawyers, and I'm a lawyer, are trained on spotting all of the issues, not ranking what actions to reduce risks of big risks. So they're, you know, look, they're very much concentrated. Well, we have to look at all of everything and make sure no risk. I advise you on all of the risks. I don't necessarily, and I might have suggestions on like eliminating what needs to happen to eliminate some of those risks, but I don't necessarily get farther than that. And you're not necessarily rewarded as a lawyer to do so. If you're coming in from outside counsel, that's especially true because they're trained to look at every single last tiny itty bitty risk because of malpractice. And so it's hard when you're looking at this and you're trying to push every issue at once, you're not really responsible, or when you're in an advisory situation, you want the client to know what all the risks are. But as an attorney, that is a lot of your job.
Yeah.
So I think it's possibly just how attorneys are trained and how they kind of escalate through the ranks doesn't reward them from advising on a pragmatic basis a lot.
Yeah. Kind of like a materiality filter across the like risk identification is not rewarded, to your point, on that sort of outside counsel side, because, hey, I'm your advisor. I got to present them all to you, and it's on you.
And, then you got to do it. And in-house that happens too, because of the distinction between, counsel being your advisor as an attorney and being your business partner as clients.
That's a great point. Yeah. A lot of folks, or at least what I've seen, is that there are many cases where your in-house folks are essentially outside counsel,
that happens a lot, kind of partner, right? Yeah. And people think, well, lawyers should be the best at doing this. And that there are a lot of good lawyers who do really great at doing this. I would like to count myself among them, obviously. But I do see a lot of lawyers who try to do this, and really all they're doing is talking more and more and more about what the law is.
Yeah.
And how there's possibly this outside chance somebody could argue that that doesn't apply. And I'm like, that needs to happen, but you also need somebody with the capability to bridge the gap.
Yeah, I love that word that you said, or that term, bridge the gap, because I think an adept sort of compliance 3.0 compliance professional, somebody who's really focused on effectiveness, they can really serve as this multilingual translator, so to speak, where I can speak to sales and I can speak to marketing and I can speak to the execs and the board, and I can translate all of this regulation and all this legalese, whatever, into what they need to know in order for them to do sales compliantly, or to do marketing compliantly, or to do retail, whatever these different things are. It's a different thing than, to your point, walking around with a sledgehammer and smashing everyone with a bunch
of- And going, hey, these are all the rules. You want to be the person, if you can, to develop a relationship with the business where if something goes wrong, they're coming to you for help.
So how do we do that?
One, don't freak out when people come to you for help.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't get upset. Thank them for coming to you. Make them the hero of your story as much as you can.
Tell me more about that point. That feels like a big point.
Yeah. Make them the people when possible. Like, obviously there are situations where you have anonymity and so you don't necessarily do this personally. But often there's things personally where you actually will showcase to their leaders how great they are, and to other leaders how much they did and how much work they did in order to solve the problem. You want to start talking about solving the problem as soon as you can. You do not dwell on fault, at least when somebody's coming to you with a problem. You just want to like treat it as something that needs to be solved. We're going to solve this. And get them involved in solving it. Usually, and if that happens, then they, first of all, A, don't think coming to you bit them in the butt. I mean, one, you're not throwing them under the bus every time you go to compliance. Like, you don't want that a reputation of that, and you want allies out there in the business who are going to talk to you. The other is it's just not a point, like in a crisis, it is not time to start pinning fault. You need to get out of that crisis, right? if there is a postmortem at some point where we look at fault, maybe. But look, you know, I know from like people coming to me about products that have caught on fire, you know, issues with privacy and there being problems, is that you want to, you can't be the one to go, oh my God.
Right.
Because you have to be that ally to calm everybody down, to take action.
Yeah, you gotta shepherd them through it. I mean, they're coming to you for some reason because you have some insight or some knowledge that they need to help get out of this problem.
They need to get out of the problem. And it's not, and I would say that there are a lot of attorneys who have been rewarded in their careers for being the person go, oh my God. Like for everything. They really, I mean, there are lawyers who have been rewarded to do have that personality.
Look what I found.
Not, look what I found. And and it's not, I'm not saying that that's true of all lawyers because it's not, but there is, there are people that, that honestly is a problem if they're going to be doing compliance. Because you have to have, people have to trust you to be their person to come to help them solve problems and not to just start figuring out who to blame.
Yeah, I guess compliance has the risk of sort of turning into a lecture versus a conversation, right? A lecture is saying, do this, do what you're supposed to do, you know, just sort of standing up there with the bullhorn. When, to your point, once we can incorporate some of that trust and you can be that true trusted ally, people understand that, geez, I'm not going to get, you know, because anybody coming to compliance, they care at some level. They care about something. They might be caring
they
about
do.
The job, care about the company. Like,
it's amazing.
There's a caring piece there. And we can't let our sort of, you know, the brand, the compliance branding problem, so to speak, that's been built over the last 20 years, you know, we can't keep carrying that that forward. You know what I'm saying? Like we have to shift at some point and revert or reverse some of that inertia to get back to, hey, human to human, let's talk about this. Let me see what I can do to help you. And when we do that, I think it provides a massive catalyst for change.
It does. And it also helps if you're that person who is willing to have the hard conversations with people where the person who may be coming to you doesn't have either the position or the political clout in order to do it. You're the person who honestly is the professional bad guy in that sense.
Oh, tell me some more about that. That's an interesting handle there.
Well, you're the person who's, I mean, when you're talking about risk and compliance, you are constantly talking to people about things that is not their core business, is not necessarily obviously going to make them money, is not necessarily part of their, you know, hopefully is part of their job, but is really in the abstract part of their job. It's, and so it's hard to be in this. I'd say people who are really great at compliance, I would like to say are people who have a lot of satisfaction in doing their job and helping the company and really care about their clients not getting hurt by, you know, regulatory issues or other issues that they should be able to avoid. Or, you know, should be able to be compliant with and also see the big picture on how it helps the company and possibly grows the company. It's hard to do that in the micro. It's hard to like get that across to people individually when they have a problem in their job. But it's, but at a high level, you know, there are certain issues that have to go well for the business to go forward. Like, for example, you know, in my most recent role, I was a privacy program manager at Shutterfly. They are the guardians of people's family photos.
Right.
And it is a it could be a serious brand problem for them.
Totally.
If there were privacy or security issues. So, you know, people get that. Like they don't get, what they don't get is this is going to give me a fine. Because they think of that as being a remote issue and not necessarily their job. But they see making the customer happy part of their job.
Interesting.
Now,
I'm sorry, I
go off on all these tangents and I forgot where we started.
No, this is a good tangent because it's an interesting thing, right? Like there are these sort of tangible, objective, you know, call it a fine. That's sort of one category of like costs for non-compliance. And those are sort of tied to like legal, regulatory, sort of well-established things, right? And then on this other side, you have the sort of softer brand. There's, you know, And it's just interesting that the focus is sort of more on the amorphous side in terms of like what the potential cost is, maybe because it's because there's no ceiling on it or something. Like, you know, a brand problem can crater a business or something. But as I was kind of thinking, you know, as I was kind of making that connection, as you were, you know, going through that illustration, I was just kind of reminded by, I was reminded of the fact that like, we have such a unique industry that we're in because it really does weave through everything.
Yeah.
It weaves through all these different aspects of an organization, all these different aspects of a business and their go-to-market strategy. And it touches the brand and it touches the employee experience and it touches the mission of the company and the gap between the aspirational culture and the actual culture. Mm-hmm. And what are we doing? You know, what wind are we blowing into the sales to try to sort of close that gap and stuff like that? It's a really interesting area that I think over the next 10 years is going to really kind of get that proper seat at the strategy table that I think it deserves. And I think once it gets unleashed, there's going to be a lot of separation between the organizations that get it and the other organizations that, you know, view this as a cost center and I'm shackled by this thing. The people that can really animate this function, I think are really going to accelerate. But let me kind of pull it back a little bit. Like, as you look at the next decade, I don't know if you brought your crystal ball with you, but if you can pull that out, like, what do you think 10 years from now, this is going to look like? And what do you think the landscape of compliance is going to look like?
I think the landscape of compliance will be more ingrained in the business, not because there'll be more converts, but I think there'll be more connection between the strategic importance of what compliance can offer from a capability standpoint. Mm-hmm. Than that actually enables the business than it happens now. For example, over the years, I've seen more business initiatives fail, not because of regulation, but because of the desire to not deal with it. The desire to not deal with it, actually like basically trim down their business plan in order to avoid some sort of application of regulation, which is like, you don't need to be afraid. It's just a lot of work. A lot of work is a lot of work, but it's not something you need to avoid, to like water down what they do in order to avoid regulation. I've seen many more businesses fail on that point than they did because if they were compliant, you know, if they just tried to comply, they could succeed.
Right.
I also see it as a matter of control, not a matter of only risk. For example, if you have a Formula One race car on a racetrack, they have great brakes. They have great brakes because they have control. They can both go fast and stay on the track without crashing. They're not afraid of either the speed or the possibility of crashing because they have control at the margins to make them as fast as possible.
Okay.
That's what in what I currently do in privacy, that's what we do with data. It's not a matter of being always being just compliant or not. It's actually a matter of having the choice at all. It's like we can choose to, the company, because of their compliance program, has the ability to make choices and actually take actions in their operations in a very short period of time that has to do with data and data management. That is control. That allows you to actually take choices in your business you couldn't have taken before.
It's an accelerant, to your point.
It's an accelerant. It's also strategic in the sense it gives you opportunity of choice. It lets you have a strategy that is more, you know, that is more either aggressive. I mean, I don't know if it's aggressive, but it makes you able to actually do things with your data you couldn't do it before.
Right.
So, you know, compliance is a use case of that. But in the world, we operate in the world with the public, and the public is also codified in the law. And people's expectations are codified in the law at least a minimum. So operating in this world is operating in this environment.
Right.
Outside the company that you can't control, but you can navigate it well with a good compliance program.
I love that analogy. That Formula One analogy is such a great one. because it really shows that this is not a this is not something to hold us back. It's something to actually allow us to go faster.
It's something to, you know, don't avoid the risk. Embrace it.
Embrace it. Lean into it.
You know, lean into it. You know, find a way to manage, find a way to deal with the risk and be fast.
Right.
There's a great on the YouTube, there's a great video and it's a comparison of Formula One in 1959. I think it's a pit stop.
Get out of here. I love that video.
Oh, you love that video? I love that video.
I tried to, I was like, I had this whole thing with this video. I wanted to do a whole video about it and talk about it. It's it takes 20 minutes on the first one. And then the other one, they're like freaking in and out.
I know, they barely, they don't even stop. Oh, it's imperceptible.
Yeah. I've seen this
video. Yeah. And how that happens is through the measurement and management of risk and continuous improvement.
Great point. Even better point than I was going to make. So I may make that point.
What's the point you're going to make? I'm curious now.
I forget, you know, it was just the fact that it was just that, that with that speed, you know, it was, you said it more elegantly, but it's that, you know, at one point it was this, look how long this took and look at now we were really able to elevate by managing risk. And, you know, it's not like the risk was eliminated from this thing. It's not like they're pouring like high octane fuel in and there's that, like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's such a beautiful picture though. It's such a beautiful analogy of this elevation that we should be doing. Like, I think to your point, I think we're going to see it over the next 10 years, but it's very exciting when we can really start getting those pit stop times down and really start accelerating through the game a lot faster, you know?
I mean, the race wasn't just won because somebody put a more powerful engine in the car.
Correct. Good point.
It really was not. The race was won because a lot of issues and a lot of risks were managed to make it possible to be fast and stay on the track without crashing. That's what won the risk, you know? So that is a much more complex set of issues. It's a more difficult set of issues, but it is a winning recipe.
Right.
It's not, you know, if you want to win, you're going to win by inches rather than miles normally. And you're going to win by actually being able to have choices and control over what you can control, which is your actions.
You know, when we dive into this a little bit more, this sort of race analogy, to your point, there's very few blowouts in races, right? Everyone's got kind of the same car. Yeah. Everyone's got, like, you know, somebody's not running on a nuclear reactor and another guy's running on like they're all running on the same kind of high octane fuel. Like they're all in the similar kind of physical sort of modifications and innovations to their, to the machine that, that they're sitting in. So then to your point, those races are won on those edges. Those, they're won on those marks. They're one on how synchronized that that team is. How good is that spotter who's kind of overseeing the track and giving that person in there, right? All these things on the side, which seem to be ancillary, you know, from the, you know, the novice looking at that, they think all the action is the guy holding the wheel. Not that there's no action there, but to your point, all the strategy and all the little, you know, things that are really going to be the differentiator are all those things that are kind of being done behind the scenes. And that's really where we can play and, you know, bringing this back to real world, right? Like that's where we can play and helping really be that differentiator in our organizations. Because again, if you have two kind of organizations of the same size and the same sort of industry, both public, whatever, the one that that kind of gets the ethics and compliance thing right, all else equal, to the extent that that getting that right provides guardrails that let people run quicker, that provide the insights and the persuasion to help people behave and do their job correctly, they're going to far outpace over, you know, the medium term, I think, the organization that views it in the archaic way, views it being, you know, compliance, views it in the archaic way of, you know, being a mere cost center that I have to have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, make, you know, and it's the communicate, the link between it being a strategic enabler and being a cost center, that is the future.
Yeah.
Of compliance.
I love it.
So I mean, when you talk about strategic enablers, it sounds like such a like clickbait kind of phrase.
I click on all clickbait, so yeah, that's why I love it.
That's why it's popular. But it's but really, it's being able to link. It's being able to see the ability. Like if Formula One was just sort of this grab bag of people who just didn't have an idea of how they were going to work together and behave a certain way in very minute detail, your team is not going to win.
Yeah.
Like, we see this now with the use of data all the time. All kinds of issues on the margins have become the differentiators of a lot of companies.
That's right. That's right.
Because we can see it and measure it, and we can actually take actions on it. That's true as well with other risks in the company or other risks or opportunities. We need to be able to see it, which means either there needs to be some sort of internal reporting or monitoring to make that rational and actionable, and you need to take action. Like, and that's in general what a lot of improvement processes are, but compliance works the same way. It's not just that there are rules that you measure against to see if we can do it, and then you put it in at one point in time and you're done.
Right.
It's a continuous process.
That's right.
That in fact escalates issues to decision makers at the right time and actually creates a framework for decision makers to make the decisions about the costs and benefit trade-offs and how they see it to actually fix issues or put processes in place, because that takes effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does take effort. And to your point, it takes ongoing effort. And it's kind of interesting that so many like smart MBA execs running companies seem to think that a compliance program is like just a bumper sticker that they put on the back of the business. Like, it's not, right? A continuous improvement initiative, whether that's in manufacturing or safety or whatever, mm-hmm. R&D, is a process that you kick off and you keep going because you're going to constantly be sharpening that blade and trying to improve it and so forth. To your point, compliance is kind of the same way. It's a continuous compliance process, and we're going to continue to try to eliminate risks to get those risks smaller and provide more clarity. And because, you know,
right.
While perfection is an ideal that's probably noble to pursue, it's never going to be attained. That doesn't mean you don't pursue it. There's value in that, and there's nobility in that, all that. So,
it also doesn't really work.
Disconnect. Yeah, it's right. It doesn't
because,
work.
Because you can, the business can only make decisions with the resources it actually has or has access to. And they have to make a lot of different choices with that. Putting the compliance end of the compliance part of things within that framework works really well, but it only really works really well in a continuous improvement process. And it is shocking how fast you can get from a no program to a very robust program in a continuous improvement process, because you're constantly taking action. You're not just pushing a very long list of agenda items.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sort of a thoughtfulness behind those activities. Those activities are not just busy work. Those are intentional, right, in pursuit of this near-term goal that's a part of a broader term, you know, longer-term goal that it's nested within and so forth.
And it gives the compliance team the reputation of being people who can get something done.
Yeah, and as an enabler, and that could be the fastest way to sort of fix this branding problem that's kind of grown up around us, you know?
It's true. It's something where I also over the years have seen compliance teams flounder because they couldn't show actionable results in quick timeframes.
Mm.
And because it really is unsatisfying for leadership and everyone involved who might be involved in the work it takes to be compliant, to not see something done. That doesn't mean that something that takes a long time, you just suddenly you just don't do it and only do quick things. It means that you're going to have to have benchmark, you're going to have deliverables quarterly,
well, again,
or at least semi-annually in order to have attention from the people.
Yeah, I mean, look, at some level, like that's just good business. And at another level, like we all have to manage there's this concept of 360 degree management. I don't know. It really, we need to expand that because it needs to be in 360 degree in all dimensions. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes,
you need to manage all around you. And if you know that you have this kind of a moniker, or you know this, you know, our profession broadly has this reputation, well, there's a really cup to your point. There's a couple of little basic things you can do to help steer away from that so that you can change that person's mind. And a lack of sort of like, they want some tangible, you know, a boss wanting some tangible evidence that there's progress being made on something that's taking up the organization's resources is not an insane request. And that's a very low bar to show some progress on and to get a box checked so that that mental loop can close in that decision maker's mind. You know what I mean?
Yes. And it's satisfying for the people who do the work, because sometimes that's the only reinforcement they get compliance. It's not like they get big bonuses for compliance normally.
Right.
I mean, and it's,
we will change that.
Yeah, actually. And there are a lot of areas where it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
There is a book out there, and I've forgotten what it's called, but it's a book about it's a case study about Alcoa. And the change in Alcoa, the steel company. Or maybe it's aluminum, but anyway, steel. They had a new CEO, and the CEO says, we're going to focus on safety. And people are like, but we have all these problems. I don't get it. Well, what happened was refocusing on safety made them re-engineer all of their processes on the floor,
mm-hmm.
which in fact was the catalyst for a lot of success. You fixed the right problem. And you also fixed things like empowerment of the line level employees.
Well, yeah, by fixing the right problem, you fixed the culture issue and the speak up issue and the, ownership issue, all that stuff.
And sometimes you need something like this, like a snowflake having a speck of dust to design around. You need an issue like compliance in order to do that. It's possible you could fix something else, but safety is something everybody can take personally. And it's also something.
There's a physicality to it, right?
There's a physicality to it. And also, if you have a lot of line level employees, there's a lot of like teamwork in that. And also people don't hurt and you don't lose your foot or something. It's very, it actually impacts a lot of people personally.
Yeah.
So, that was an interesting case study because it did show how a compliance effort can really lead to business results that are better.
Man, I feel like we could, I should call this the good point episode, because I feel like I've said that so many times over the last, time we've been talking. So let me ask you this, Leona, what drives you? What's your why? What's the fuel in you that really motivates you to, try to make a difference?
I love reaching out across functions and collaborating with people to put solutions in place. I also love going, collaborating across levels to make sure that decisions can be made, whether they're made in the way I want is another issue, in a timely and fast fashion that doesn't create a lot of drama. And the reason I like all this is I care about the business getting hurt. I have a knack and a training that makes me focus on things like risk and how it can be damaging or thwart people's best efforts to do great things. And I don't want that to happen. I want the great things and the best efforts and people's hard work to achieve and actually succeed, or, as their business models to work.
Yeah.
And I just happen to be one of those people that really can see how some risk issues need to be navigated in order to make that happen.
What a strong frame, though. I mean, again, if you're talking about reaching out across the silo or across the aisle to just start that conversation, it's such a strong thing to say, listen, I've seen risk 1,000 times derail people's best efforts.
Yeah.
My job is to make sure that your best efforts are not derailed by that. I'm here to assist you. It's just such a different frame than the adversarial thing that is the stereotype of compliance. You know what I'm saying?
I know. Looking at a compliance program, often one place to start is to look at what you think the stereotype of compliance is and what you think you would like to be known as. I would like the compliance program to be known as helpful. I would like the people in the compliance program to see as having integrity. I would like people to be able to rely on us to be a calm force of action, like somebody who's not going to freak out.
Yeah.
An organizing force so things aren't emergencies. A leadership approach when things are emergencies, like something like that, right? And then look at what you do and see what you can put in place to help do that. And sometimes there are actual tactics. Like some things are really mushy, like don't be freaking out is like kind of a mushy topic. But sometimes it's things like, well, let's make sure that we deliver updates to leadership and make sure all of the people up the down the chain are getting credit for the work they do on a very regular basis. It's before Smart. Before the quarterly meeting. Yep. So that this, if something comes up, they can talk about it without feeling like they're flat-footed on this issue. Like Great. Helpful.
Simple.
That only, helpful. You know, simple. You know, let's make sure we have a rhythm so that let's make sure we build tools in our compliance process that will raise issues earlier before there's a problem so they can be corrected so that people, it doesn't just run away with itself right. until there's a calamity. And then the compliance people come down and just beat everybody up.
Yeah.
Let's try and like set this up to succeed. Yeah.
Yeah. And then to your point, when you don't have those canaries deep enough in the coal mine, then compliance comes in and they're in a panic because I mean, think they have their own nervousness because they don't want to be perceived as having dropped the ball. So that just incorporates so much opportunity for conflict and like ineffectiveness and miscommunication and just, you know what I'm saying? Bumping up against each other, which to
it's
your point,
true. And
making it harder for us to get to the goal of let's extinguish this risk. Let's put the guardrails in place and let's run after our mission together, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's like make sure that coming to compliance or working with compliance isn't a career limiting problem.
Yeah.
Like, you know, let's make sure that you can be the person working with somebody that you're listening to them and what their concerns are about maybe a process or something else and just acknowledging that they have real concerns at the bare minimum
and that they're like valid.
Valid even if you think they're wrong or something else or maybe somebody else needs to weigh in or whatever it's like these people have to do their jobs it's incumbent, I think, upon the compliance department to create a situation where the circumstances are that compliance is part of their jobs, meaning their leaders are actually acknowledging this work is going on and they support it. At least they support it, or at least they don't want to be seen as not supporting it.
Right.
Because not everybody is going to be on the same page at the same time. Like, they're just not. So at a minimum, they don't want to be the person that says to the other, their peers across the company that they don't support the thing that half of their peers in the company are.
Yeah. And listen, getting back to your Alcoa. That's a phenomenal point. Getting back to your Alcoa example, it very quickly became a tenet of their culture that safety mattered. That's not an insurmountable task. Alcoa is a freaking massive company, and it was a massive company, and they were able to get that done in pretty short order, if I remember right. So it's about an initiative, and it's about a voice from the top, and it's about a support from the middle, and it's about this buy-in that is not that hard to get.
It's not that hard to get, and it's also something where people don't want to be the person. First, they may think they'll never be the person that says safety doesn't matter. That's just not what they'll do. What it is when they're talking about their little quadrant of the company, they don't want change in certain ways, or they think that things should be run a different way. But they're not going to say, I mean, the nice thing about things like safety is if you can like connect compliance to the business outcomes, you can get a lot of people who will buy in, and they won't necessarily, people aren't all about resistance, really.
No, they're not.
They will pick their hill to die on. They're not going to They're not going to pick safety doesn't
every
matter
hill.
As their hill to die on.
Correct.
They're not going to pick every hill. Like if you have a publicly traded company who's online and has this huge reputation with millions of consumers, you're not going to necessarily pick, we don't care about their safety online or the use of their data as their hill to die on.
Right.
If at the top, they've decided, you know, the company has decided with compliance that this needs to happen.
Right.
That privacy needs to happen. Now that in the details, there are a lot of choices to be made, but there is something to be said for make sure essentially the initiatives are branded in a way that people can see their personal interest in it.
Yeah. And I think what you said, you know, you said something a couple of minutes ago you said, you know, people shouldn't feel like going to compliance is a career-ending thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Great. So now let's flip that and say, so then what should they expect? Well, then they should expect, it should be the exact opposite of that first statement. They should expect going to compliance is a career-making thing. But that can only happen if compliance is doing the job of speaking out into the organization, not only, hey, look at the progress we are making, but also look at all these people that are keeping this ship afloat and giving them that recognition so that it can separate them from their peers. Because
exactly,
it takes a lot for someone to speak up. It takes a lot for someone to come to compliance and say, hey, I think I screwed something up, because are they putting their job on the line? Are they going to be met with that, you know,
that
stereotypical panic that comes from a compliance officer, and then they're going to get roasted for it, and they're going to lose their job, and then they can't go on vacation, whatever all those things are. They have to overcome all those things to raise their hand. And to your point, we should be pushing for organizations full of whistleblowers, full of people who are willing to speak up, because it allows us to run faster at our organization's mission.
Right. There's, you know, in its very essence, you know, when I was, well, back in the, way back when I was a little girl, people would talk about the dawning of the information age, right? And now we really feel the information age more than I did when I was a little girl. The information only really helps you well if it's correct.
Yeah.
Having people stand up and say this is wrong or that is wrong, it's actually giving you a piece of information to actually adjust your point of view to be more, that be less off base. Like, it's, you know, so.
A great point.
So, you know, it's that's where you get these high concept issues where at the top it makes sense, but sometimes in the middle it gets thwarted because of where people sit and what they see. But it's like, those people who are speaking, who are truth tellers to power, are important assets, even though they might be a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
Because you can only go forward. The better information you have, the better choices you can make in your company. And it's not just the compliance issues. That's like the most, that's the clearest like speck of dust that this snowflake designs around, right? But that behavior happens everywhere. If people are comfortable speaking up, they're comfortable speaking up in all kinds of issues, not just the compliance issues.
That's
so, you know, so that's where you have that cultural change. It's not as though these particular cultural differences are only siloed in regulatory issues. That doesn't happen that way.
Exactly.
It might be that regulatory issues are the clearest and most measured way that you can do it, but it actually is a capability in the company to have truthful and accurate information and escalation of problems or issues that then it will bleed over to everything else. People don't operate with that skill just in a tiny silo and then keep everything under wraps everywhere else. It doesn't work that way. Yeah.
Right. So this has been a great conversation. You've had some really great analogies. I feel like I've learned a lot. Let me ask you this. Where can people find you? Where can people learn more about you?
Well, you can learn more about me, of course, on LinkedIn. I'm Leona Lewis. And I used to have like a podcast a long time ago. Yeah, it's called Masters of Disaster.
Well, re-release that, will you?
Well, that's a good idea. Maybe I will, actually. It'll take me a couple of months to do that, but it's, we'll see. And then, so, you know, I'm currently in transition and I just left my previous role a month ago. So right now, LinkedIn actually is the best place to get to me. And the contact information that's on LinkedIn is also the best contact information to get to well, actually email me or call me. Yeah.
I mean, you are truly somebody who's a compliance 3.0, you know, you're like a bastion of compliance 3.0. All the stuff you're talking about are the things that we're trying to talk about on this podcast, trying to get more people to recognize that we have the potential to be a strategic asset, to be an accelerant to the organization, to reach across the lines and be that bridge and be that translator and really try to build trust within the organization, because so much magic can come from it. And I feel like, you know, you kind of should teach the course, because everything we talk about, you kind of talked about in your own experience, and you know, after, you know, kind of getting to know you, wherever you land, they're going to be super lucky to get you. You are really a powerhouse, and I'm just so thankful that you came on and shared some of your day with us.
Well, I really appreciated this opportunity to talk with you, because I mean, I see you, I was seeing you on LinkedIn, and you really are just an evangelist for this everywhere. And plus, just a kind of fun person to talk to.
Well, thank you. You made my day. So it looks like two for two here. Well done, Leona.